ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
You can't have sport at this level without politics. Uh-huh. But seriously, there's no such thing as a FIFA Peace Prize. It was invented to keep Donald Trump on side and on focus to get to the deadline of a FIFA World Cup.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Telstra's outage has caused dismay and anger across the country, and as problems continue into a second day, questions are being asked about whether further regulation is needed. So, what could be the impacts for Telstra's bottom line? And the latest rent data shows a troubling picture for those looking for somewhere to live. Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC business reporter Daniel Ziffer.
Daniel Ziffer, thank you so much for joining us. Let's just get straight into it. It is the biggest story, not just really in the business world, but really in the nation, I would say, at this point. Yesterday, we had this, what turned out to be massive outage in the Telstra network. Now, originally, the CFO seemed to suggest he thought it would be more likely thousands were impacted than even tens of thousands. I think it's very clear that that is not the case. This hit people across the country. People weren't able to use their phones. It's caused chaos on transport networks with trains not able to run in some circumstances. And I think what's even more troubling is originally we were told this wasn't going to affect people's access to 000. But now into the second day, Telstra says that there are still issues with people in some circumstances accessing 000. I mean, what do you make of the way that this has happened, played out over the last 24 hours? And what questions do you think there are for Telstra at this point?
Well, it certainly served to remind us how much we rely on digital network connectivity for everything that we do, for so many parts of business, for so many parts of life. Now, the pointiest end is when people need to access emergency services, which they generally do by calling on the phone. More and more Australians have gotten rid of landlines as those costs have increased. They've got mobile phones. We have essentially more mobile phones than we have people in Australia. Now, the mobile phone system is meant to piggyback on itself in emergencies. So if you are somewhere, doesn't matter where, and you call for emergency services, it will go with your provider first. If that signal isn't strong enough or unavailable, it will go with the next one, the next one, the next one down the line to get you through. The issue appears to be here that that hasn't been working and that people haven't been able to access emergency services. Now, Telstra has been doing as what's required to do under law, which is to do welfare checks on people. So if people have tried to contact emergency services and have been unable to, they are calling them back or getting the police to contact those people. That is probably the most troubling ongoing aspect. But to bring it back more broadly, it is a reminder of how desperately connected we are and how many systems rely on something that we take for granted as always going to be there.
Because this is still unfolding, it is important for us to timestamp this conversation. We're speaking at 11:45 in the eastern states here in Australia. We may get updates, although Telstra at the moment is saying that the next update won't happen for another bit over 3 hours. I think you're right. I think once again, it demonstrates how important telecommunications is to the way that our society functions at the moment and how destabilizing it is when it goes wrong. Now, part of what Telstra said in response to what's happened is that its systems are built with, as they call it, multiple layers of resilience, including redundant core network systems, geographic diversity across key network elements, backup power systems, diverse routing, and 24/7 operational monitoring. Now, that all sounds great. Those are a lot of words, but this does once again call into question whether or not those systems are adequate if something can take out such a large part of the network. Now, redundancy costs money, and it can't. There are echoes to me of what happened when we had the pandemic, where up until then we kind of had the just-in-time mentality, where we would, you know, be reliant on one thing coming to a warehouse as one goes out, and that you never had too much stock building up because that comes with associated costs. And then when the pandemic happened, suddenly everyone thought, oh, actually, maybe we need more redundancy built into the system. Maybe there needs to be a little bit extra, you know, a little bit extra padding, a little bit extra toilet paper.
Maybe we should make some fertilizer in Australia, like even a little bit.
Yeah. We don't know exactly what's happened here. It appears to be a software update, something to do with synchronization of time. The secondary issue, I've tried to get answers from Telstra about exactly what's going on, because it's slightly confusing to me still whether or not they're saying there are other issues in addition to people being able to access 000. Hopefully we will get greater clarity about it soon. And I think there will be real questions asked about whether or not the current regulations about the way that these telecommunications companies operate and their systems in place, whether or not they are appropriate, because we all do so heavily rely upon this. Now, a lot of business does not like heavy-handed regulation because no one likes red tape, as it's called, because it makes it more difficult, they think, to be innovative, to do the things they want to do, the most efficient way of operating their business. But I think when it comes to these type of critical pieces of infrastructure, that you do need to have pretty heavy regulation to ensure that this doesn't happen, because this is catastrophic. There were, people who couldn't get around yesterday and this morning because transport wasn't able to run. The cost of business, I think it is a little bit more confusing about how heavy the impact will be. People may not have been able to pay if they weren't able to use their phones, or maybe they couldn't get to an appointment because they couldn't contact the person in question. And then there's that question about, well, what kind of compensation is available to people? And do you think we have – I was trying to look this up, Dan, about previous outages and what the compensation was for people. And I think it's deliberately opaque because – they don't necessarily want people involved in future, victims of future outages, to know how much they can potentially ask for. But we could be seeing both heavy fines for Telstra, right? But also there could be some hefty requests for compensation, including, we believe, from public transport companies.
Certainly, it is difficult to quantify compensation. I think about if someone was going to go and buy a fry pan or a set of golf clubs yesterday, well, they'd probably do it today. The people who probably lost the most are those who see transactions disappear into thin air. So, for example, cab drivers, cafes, they have lots of small transactions. If they can't take money, they can't make money. And people don't tend to kind of defer those things in the same way. We have seen compensation previously. It will be interesting to see. At the moment, probably the largest and most affected network is the Victorian train network, not metropolitan, country. So what's called the V-Line network hasn't operated for 2 days now. Now, they've absorbed a lot of extra costs because they've hired every bus in the world to try and move people that normally travel by train. But that is an example of an operator that's seen a really substantial loss. Now, they would have a business contract with Telstra for their services. So there might be some compensation or some kind of service level agreement there. We won't find that out for some time. I think for most people, Telstra will probably do the right thing about a portion of their bill for a portion of time. But it really does come back to that question that you raise about redundancy. Businesses aren't going to pay for two different gas providers to put pipes in to keep their machines going. They aren't going to pay for two different electricity providers. They are also unlikely to pay for two different mobile phone or data providers unless they absolutely need to. These are costs for business. And we've gotten very used to really high reliability. I'm always telling my children in my, ceaseless endeavor to prove how old I am, we used to have blackouts all the time. When I was growing up in the country, it was something that happened like with regularity. Like I knew where the candles were. It wasn't like it was every night, but it happened every month. Now we never have a blackout. We had one
almost never. Yeah,
we had one recently, and they're just like, "What's this?" And you're like, "Well, this is when the lights go out."
Also, I haven't asked this technical question, but one of the things that strikes me is that if there is a system in place that 000 calls, if you can't make it through your existing network, it can be patched through another network. Why can't that happen more broadly? For example, if the Telstra network goes down, is it not possible that all traffic or a substantial amount of that traffic can be patched through the Optus or Vodafone networks for just that period? Now, obviously, there'd have to be a some sort of payment involved, but it surprises me that if there is some sort of ability to patch through, is that something that you can kind of work out? And then you're right. I think most people are not. You know, think about that one and get back
to
it.
Well, no, it's true. No, that's what happens overseas. That can absolutely happen. It just doesn't happen. Will it be something that might occur as a result of this? Yeah, probably.
Okay, we'll see if we can raise that question. And then the other thing that struck me was, yes, most people are not going to have a second phone. Most people aren't going to have a second account, particularly for the business level. But I do wonder if some people will be trying to differentiate whether it might be within the family or I'm not sure exactly between your work phone and your personal phone in order to have this access to these different networks.
It's not a crazy idea. One of the issues with the Optus outage was they couldn't contact each other because they were all on Optus. I spoke to the CFO, Michael Ackland, just before he spoke yesterday. I said, when did you get the call? How did you get the call? And he said, look, it was intermittent. This was the problem. It was an intermittent problem, which means not all the time. So he actually did get the call very early in the morning. And I think they do have a range of devices there because they've seen what happened with Optus, where their senior leadership couldn't talk to each other. I remember trying to get the then CEO of Optus on the phone, and they kind of they'll try and do it on Teams. They'll try and do it on like online, all these kind of other ways because they hadn't built in that redundancy of having other systems if their own went down.
So when we try to work out what impact this is potentially going to have on Telstra's bottom line, people talk in terms of, reputational risk and that this might damage Telstra's reputation and therefore its value. And Telstra does, I think, get a premium because it is the biggest telco, it argues it has the best range, it has the best reliability. Maybe this tarnishes it a little bit, but there's not a whole lot of options. And we've spoken about the Optus outage.
What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Do you think there is real risk when it comes to reputation, or is the biggest monetary consequence for Telstra that there could be a fine, there could be a compensation, but that we could see tighter regulation and potentially a change to the penalties that are doled out in these type of circumstances?
Well, I think that's where the financial risk is for them then. There's only a small market here in Australia. Optus covers well the capital cities and the country. Vodafone has recently put out ads mocking people who spend money on infrastructure in regional and remote Australia. So you can't really go on them. The cost will be in the potential for new regulation that, for example, forces networks to piggyback onto others when theirs goes down. We look at the potential for fines. I wouldn't be too worried about that. Last year, Telstra made $2.3 billion. They got a previous fine for a short 000 outage in 2024, and that was $3 million. Even Optus's much larger outage cost them $12 million in fines. So when you're talking about companies that make billions of dollars in profit, these are rounding errors in their accounting. So it's probably not going to be the fine regime. It's probably going to be the likelihood of regulation increasing cost for them in having to have more redundancy. We see this with the banks, right? When they do something wrong, when they're made to hold more capital. They're made to store more money as a penalty. It costs them money to just have money sitting there. So it might be something like that where they have to improve their redundancy of their systems and that comes with cost.
Yeah, the market reaction was interesting. I mean, we saw share price dropping about 3%. It's actually up slightly today. Potentially markets are, thinking that the worst of it's already over. That is interesting to me. 3% is not a huge result. People obviously don't think this is imperils the business in a major way. I mean, what do you think is the most likely outcome here, Dan? Is this something that we forget about in a few weeks, that this was a couple of days of chaos? Or do you get the feeling that the government is seriously going to be looking at regulation? I think one of the difficulties, particularly when it comes to some of these technical aspects, is that are we really going to have regulators in there looking at the way that software updates are worked through.
How many nodes have you got?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing, well, maybe there's a very simple rule, which is that no software updates occur while the CEO is out of the country. That might be one for PR management in the future.
It's going to be like, yes, would you update software on your TV broadcast as a World Cup match is going on? Probably not, but maybe wait for another time. I think it's more likely that there will be something to come out of this. Obviously, we've seen with Telstra now, we've seen it with Optus previously, not just the outages, but how much we rely on these institutions that are private, listed, for profit. Government has...
Yeah, and remember, the history here is that Telstra, as it was previously called, Telecom, was previously government-owned. It was floated. It was made a private, public company, but it was listed. So it has shareholders that aren't the government. And part of the argument was to create a situation where there were competitive pressures, where you could open up the market, have different telecommunications companies competing. And one of the ways you compete is how you choose to invest your money in technology and how you try to get an advantage by the type of systems that you are using. And economists would argue that's good for consumers. It leads to lower prices. It allows them to differentiate. But when it is so critical, that infrastructure is so critical, I think obviously there is a role for government to play in regulating it to ensure that you're not left with the situation where there's underinvestment or things go awry, which cause catastrophic impact to the economy.
Over its whole life, Telstra has really struggled with its universal service obligations. It is much easier and cheaper to just service rich inner city suburbs where there are lots of consumers. It is more expensive to provide services to people who live in regional and remote Australia, particularly when we have a small population across a vast continent that is largely centred in large urban areas. They have competitors who do that, who just focus on those things. It has always been an issue for them because of that tension, because they are a private company that is trying to make money, but also they are a vital and essential service. I think we're going to see a bit more exploration of that tension as we get into this issue. But I agree with you. Very difficult for the regulators to come in and say how many nodes you've got, how dispersed are you, how many people have you got working on this stuff. It is probably going to be more to do with overall service levels and what's known as uptime and how frequently this occurs. But given that we've had a few outages in recent years, I don't think this focus will go away just when the problem is sorted and every node gets rebooted.
Yeah, and obviously with the risk of artificial intelligence being able to find flaws, ways into infrastructure, these issues will become only more pronounced.
They will. I will say on the flip side of that, one of the really clever things that AI does is it's better at finding problems before they start. It's like concepts like data mining, where you don't know what you don't know, but the technology can make links between things. One of the really substantial things AI can do in infrastructure, and I mean this in electricity pipes, water pipes, all this kind of stuff, is it actually can work out where problems will occur in the future and deal with them while it's cheaper and easier.
Dan, while I've got you, I want to talk about the most recent rent data that we've received, which really tells an awful picture for those people who are looking to currently find a place to live. Now, this data, we've got kind of three different sources that are out today. They all tell a pretty similar story. I'm most across the domain data, so I'll look most closely at that. But really, the story that they are telling is that rents, advertised rents, are accelerating in price. Renters have really struggled since the pandemic, and the huge increase in migration that we saw after that seems to be one of the major factors. But there are also questions about whether or not the more recent increase, I saw Dr. Nicola Powell from Domain suggested that she did think perhaps there was some evidence that landlords who were first hearing rumours and murmurings that the government might be looking to change the taxation arrangements around property before they were actually announced in the budget might have taken the opportunity to hike rents. Now, in the longer term, economists all basically agree that what drives rents higher is the link between supply and demand. And if there isn't enough places for rent and there's too much demand, then we see rents continue to increase. So even if landlords maybe did have a look at their portfolio if they've got multiple properties, or maybe they're one property and thought, I'm going to try and get ahead of this by hiking now. The only reason they can do that is because there is very low vacancy rates in Australia, and so they have the power in order to hike rents. But it is a horrible picture for renters, and it also has a major impact on the inflation problem that Australia is facing. With the last ABS data that we received showed that housing as a category was the biggest driver of the high inflation that we saw then. Now, that was also made up of electricity, but rent was a major component there. But what did you make of this data? And do you think we pay enough attention to what the plight of renters? I feel like so much of the focus is on property prices, people buying, and not much as much attention is paid to renters.
So about one in three Australians rent where they live, a further third paying off a mortgage, and about one third have paid off their housing. Those figures used to be a very simple third, third, third. It's now a smaller number of people have paid off, a larger number of people are renting and still paying off, as those debts are so large, they take longer to knock off. The thing I keep coming back to is rents as a key cost of living, and housing is the biggest cost of living that we talk about, just outpace wages massively. On this new data, rents have gone up 3% in a quarter. The last time we looked at wages, they went up at 0.8% in a quarter. They've gone up annually 7.7% for rents. Wages for the year to March rose 3.3%. So you have your largest cost.
And this data, you're talking about houses in capital cities.
Yes, yes. So the unit prices have gone up less. They have certainly gone up less. They have activated with not as much velocity. But what we're talking about here also is a system that for years has had this gap, where it has been running much faster than people's increased ability to pay. So it's becoming a larger proportion of what they spend their money on. There's a lot of reasons for it. It's not as simple as migration. It's very linked with the amount that we build. It's linked to how much space people want, which changed after COVID. People wanted more space. It's linked to planning. It's so deeply enmeshed. It's such a difficult problem to solve. But the reality of it comes down to this. There are one in three Australians paying an immense amount of what they earn every week to live, to have a roof over their head. That amount is increasing. It is generally increasing at beyond what they earn. So it is consuming more and more over time.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is a complicated picture. But I do think when you look at the graph showing migration rates taking off at the, you know, when the we start to see restrictions lifting post-COVID, you've seen this explosion in rents. I mean, in the years leading up to the pandemic, we were relatively flat with rents for a sustained period. The explosion in the last 5 years is quite extraordinary. It is also important for us to point out that, because I've had some audience feedback before on this issue, when we're looking at Domain or Cotality or PropTrack, they're looking at advertised rents. The ABS data looks at trying to track how much overall people pay increases in their rental costs.
So there's existing rents.
It's both, yeah, yes. Exactly. So they try to work out the increases that people have already got a place that they've stayed in for a few years, what increase they're seeing, as well as the advertised costs. But it is still absolutely relevant to look at the advertised costs, because this is for people who are currently trying to rent a place. This is what you're seeing. And the concern is, I think, partly that because we're seeing such high increases in rent that people are then kind of what we were seeing in the property market, say, last year, which is like you're so desperate to get something because you're scared it's going to get higher and higher and higher. So it also just feeds into this desperation of people trying to secure a place. And absolutely, most economists will say at the end of the day, the only way you can solve this is to bring supply and demand into better alignment. And that means building more places. And you're right that there are, I think earlier on, there was an argument that perhaps there was an aspect of people wanting to live with less people that was partly driving it. But I think in recent years, there's a pretty strong correlation between high population growth. And, you know, that comes with different benefits as well. But I think that is part of the story here. What do you think the RBA would be making when they look at this most recent data? We heard from Sarah Hunter, the chief economist, yesterday doing a speech, which was obviously closely watched to see what we might learn when it comes to interest rate interest rate outlook, surely they're not going to be happy about seeing how quickly rents are continuing to rise.
No, it certainly would be go into the hot mess that we're currently dealing with of essentially a kind of geopolitical perma-crisis where we see things popping up all the time that we have very little control over, but which affect our trade, affect our economy, and really affect cost of living and way of life. All of these things are going to feed into very tough discussions when they look at the price of money, which they'll next be judging in about a month from now in August.
Yeah, and I think the market seems pretty split at the moment. I mean, I was looking at money markets this morning suggesting maybe 25% chance of a rate hike in August. Economists do seem split on this issue about whether or not what we saw from Sarah Hunter was just an attempt to jawbone. They don't want people thinking that rates are going to be dropping anytime soon because that could lead to people maybe going out and spending more money now, which defeats the purpose of the interest rate hikes that we've already seen. Perhaps that is part of it, but I do think they seem genuine when they say that they are standing by and they are ready to hike if they think that inflation is not coming down in a sustained way. There will be another hit of inflation data and another hit of labor market data before they make that decision. I think they are going to be critical, and we will get that updated statement of monetary policy document, which gives us an idea of what the Reserve Bank thinks about the outlook for the Australian economy. The IMF, you know, report out today, which is based on Australian forecast, but you know, paints a pretty sad picture of pretty low economic growth. But the Reserve Bank also thinks seemingly that anything above 2% growth, which used to be considered, you know, low, Australia hits its constraints when it comes to inflation. So in some ways, even though that number might not be particularly exciting or seem like it would be a good number, maybe the Reserve Bank would be happy to be reading that because it maybe means that we're not going to see higher inflationary pressures.
They have been laser focused on inflation for the past couple of years. Anyone who's read their stuff or followed this knows that has been their focus. It will remain their focus. It's higher than they want. Kind of tells you everything.
And that is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. Tomorrow, be sure to catch That's Business with Alan Kohler, who will be sitting down with Australian-American economist Justin Wolfers, who joins Alan to take a broad and fascinating brush across the economics of Trump's America and how the decisions made in Washington still ripple all the way to Australia. And Alan also does his journalistic duty and asks if Justin got an invite to the Taylor Swift Travis Kelce wedding in New York City. Well, let's see what chance he gives. And Dan, you'll be me for the next little while I take a bit of a break, but I'll be back. And dear listeners, I leave you in safe ABC business team hands.
Yes, Kerrigan, have a great break. I'll take the keys, and just like a modern electric vehicle, it will have fantastic pace but erratic control.
Fantastic. Suspension will be good too. Remember to never miss an episode. Make sure you're following ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Dan.
See you later.